us and guide us. In Christ's name, amen. My name is Grant Abbott. I'm an Episcopal priest in St. Paul, Minnesota now. Used to live in Seattle, Washington, and worked at St. Mark's Cathedral, but went to Minnesota because my wife got a job on the faculty of the University of Minnesota teaching there. I'm now the rector of a small Episcopal parish. It's near the St. Paul campus of the university, but also three blocks from Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary, which some of you may know even better than I, though I support at least one student a year with the number of books I buy in the bookstore. It's a great resource for me. I've taken classes there and enjoy it, and I've had a Lutheran woman seminarian for a year and a half from there. Now I have an Episcopal woman seminarian who's also attending Luther Northwestern, and I've taken a few classes from the new president, David Teedy, who I admire a great deal and I think is going to lead Luther Northwestern into being an outstanding institution. My credentials for this go back to my seminary days, in which I became interested in ethics and moral theology, and then went and spent a year studying with Lawrence Kohlberg and James Fowler at Harvard Divinity School when I changed denominations from the Presbyterian Church to the Episcopal Church, and then followed that up later with advanced study at the University of Minnesota, and for the last 7 years have been the examiner in ethics and moral theology in the Diocese of Minnesota. And I've taught this course before, and I use it primarily as a laboratory course for people, because we are all moral philosophers, more or less. And the kind of thing we're going to be doing is like that which was done in the PBS series Ethics in America. How many of you happen to catch any of the episodes of Ethics in America? Well, it was, I think, an outstanding series in that it took moral dilemmas, brought people together, and then there was a moderator who posed the dilemma and then tried to draw out of the people who were there their best thoughts and ideas, playing in some cases the devil's advocate, always asking why, or saying, well, if Jane says this, Bill said this over here, how do you put those two things together? The one, and then also the moderator takes this simple dilemma and then keeps making it more and more difficult as we go along. The one thing that the series did not do was talk at all about making moral decisions. I was really flabbergasted that after all of that wonderful presentation, there was nothing at the end to say, well, what do we do about this? Isn't it interesting that we can't resolve any of these moral dilemmas? People have very differing opinions. Why do we have those? How do we go about doing this? Fred Friendly at the end would just sort of give a little wrap-up and talk about next week, and that was it. However, they do have a book that goes with it, Ethics in America, which does try to do more than that. However, it's quite expensive, I warn you, even though it's paperback. I do have some handouts. They are bibliography stuff, if you're interested. And I also have moral dilemmas. There are many more people here than I expected, so we're going to have to share these. And then I'm going to have to ask you to give them back to me, because I'm going to use them each time. Okay? I've said something about myself. Now, I just, unfortunately, I don't think we have enough time to go around and get something about everybody. But I would like to try to get everybody's name, okay? As best I can here. And then maybe if you stick with me, we'll know each other by the end of the week.
Janet Barr.
Janet.
Steve?
Steve.
Cindy.
Cindy.
Amy?
Amy.
Carol?
Carol.
Carol?
Carol. Kara. Is that correct? Okay.
Doris.
Doris.
Emil.
Emil.
Georgine.
Georgine?
Artis.
Artis?
Floyd?
Floyd.
Dean.
Dean.
Claire.
Claire.
Scott.
Scott.
Jerry.
Anne.
Brad.
Brad.
Okay, let's start with the second row here.
Dan from Japan.
Great. One of my best friends is there in Sendai.
Oh, I'll teach Ed.
Ed. Ed.
Janet.
Janet.
Tyrone.
Tyrone.
Jan.
Carol.
Carol.
Helen.
Helen.
Eileen.
Eileen.
Ed.
Ed.
Norman.
Norman. I guess back.
Diane.
Diane.
Bill.
Bill.
Joe.
Joe.
Sonia.
Hi, Sonia.
Holly.
Holly.
Okay. Erling.
Erling.
Esther.
Esther. Okay, I believe that's everybody. I hope also maybe you got to know one another's names too. The reason I want to do this is that in doing this this laboratory experience, sometimes there can be disagreements. Some of these dilemmas are not easy, and it's good to know one another's names and not to call each other names. Okay. Let me give you a sense then of what we are going to be doing throughout the week. In terms of describing this, you know, why would I want to do this? What am I going to get out of it? I listed three things. The first thing, I believe, is an opportunity to stretch the muscles, our moral muscles, and to make them more flexible. And then the opportunity actually to exercise those muscles. And then I hope, through some lecturing that I'll be doing, an opportunity to gain some training tips for developing moral endurance, if you'll pardon the analogy to distance running. But that's, in a sense, what I'm hoping that we can do. Today we're going to just start out basically and look at facing moral dilemmas. It's sort of a general overview of the week. The next session tomorrow we'll be looking at the issue, what about the rules? Where do we get the rules? Where do they come from? Then we'll look at another session on Thursday at, well, what about the consequences? Which is also, in a certain sense, rules, if you follow utilitarians and Mill, but we will look more specifically at that aspect. And then the next session on Friday, we will look at, what about moral character, virtues, and things like that? Where does that fit in? And then finally, on Saturday, I want to take up a larger issue of, but is it fair? And the extreme importance nowadays of understanding issues of social justice and the complexity of them and the fact that there is no predominant view, really, of social justice right now. A lot of competing theories of justice, and we will look at those. I have suggested three books, of which only one is in right now. Karen Labak, who teaches at Pacific School of Religion, has written a book, Six Theories of Justice. It is in. You may want to start reading it now for the Saturday session by Augsburg. A book by a fellow at Fuller Theological Seminary, an evangelical, Lewis B. Smead's Choices, Making Right Decisions in a Complex World. I found this book extremely helpful for lay people and for just teaching, getting a sort of a general foundation on which to build. And if you desire to build, you can. This book, unfortunately, is only in hardback. It's a book by Tom Beecham. It's called Philosophical Ethics and Introduction to Moral Philosophy. It is your classic textbook, but I like it. It starts with dilemmas, it has readings from the philosophers, and then commentary on it. So it's a real engaging book. It's not such a dry book. And it deals with the whole level of both normative ethics and what's called meta-ethics, that is sort of thinking about theories of ethics and moral language and stuff. It's a very good book, unfortunately expensive, unless you can get it through Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary bookstore, which gives a good discount. You also need to know that there is a strong debate going on in ethical circles today. There are lots of people questioning dominant liberal moral theory. And one of the leaders of that group is a Christian theologian named Stanley Hauerwas, who teaches at Duke. I would suggest this book, A Community of Character Toward a Constructive Christian Social Ethic, to find somebody who is reaching back, in a sense, to Aristotle and Aquinas, and trying to update that for today, and raises questions of the sufficiency of the liberal tradition of which most of us are a part and of which I'm a part. So that's that. Let me now pass around these moral dilemmas, and you can share them, okay, one with another. Take every other person. We're going to just take one today. It's a classic moral dilemma. It's the one I got sort of the first day in class from Lawrence Kohlberg, and many of you have dealt with it before. But it is the Heinz dilemma, and I like to work with it. But let me just say something about moral dilemmas. And, you know, why do we deal with these things? Well, let's take, for example, the case of someone who finds himself or herself in the midst of a dysfunctional family. What do you do? What is the morally right thing to do in this case? Do you leave your spouse? Do you turn your parents in? Does this conflict with certain rules that we've heard of on other occasions? Or imagine yourself as the pastor of a congregation. You've been going along fine here for 2 or 3 years. You have a wonderful assistant who's helping you out. A prominent member of the congregation comes in and says, I believe that the assistant is a homosexual. And if you don't get the resignation of that person right now, I'm leaving the parish. What do you do? Or let me give you another Jane Doe case. A woman who is a manic depressive comes knocking at your door, and says, I'm being pursued by the CIA and the FBI. You have to hide me. You have to protect me. Then you get a phone call from the parents and say that this daughter of ours is very sick and needs to be institutionalized, and we need your cooperation to hold her there until we can get the authorities there to have her institutionalized. What do you do? What do you do when later this same woman is exhibiting very odd behavior, but is not showing any clear signs of child abuse? No marks on the child, nothing there other than would require an examination by child protection. You turn her into child protection. Child protection starts to come around. She flees, takes her son and a gun, and in fact, a week later, murders her son, 3 years old. That's a real dilemma that I had to face. Tragedy. Awful. But you don't have time to sit there and go back to your ethics books and think, ooh, gee, what do I do now? You don't. You have to act like that. And that's why I think exercising our moral physique is as important as our physical physique. And there are people that say sometimes, well, why do you make such a big deal? It's easy, you know? I mean, you just follow the rules. And we got the Ten Commandments. And we got the Sermon on the Mount. People tell me all the time that don't come to church. I follow the Ten Commandments. I have the Sermon on the Mount. That's what I follow. I lead. That's my life. But what happens when those rules conflict? What happens when you're in a dysfunctional family? It says, honor thy father and thy mother. But they're beating on you. Or your dad's a drunk. What do you do? And then there are other people that say, well, you just do the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. It's as simple as that. You don't have to do any more than that. But what happens when you run into the fanatic who says, I don't care if I were born a Jew. I'm a Nazi, and I believe in Nazism, and if I were born a Jew, I ought to be eliminated. And what about the person who simply loves trumpet music and thinks it's the greatest thing in the world, and he plays his trumpet at 2 a.m. in the morning, and you say, well, don't do that. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Hey, I'd love it if somebody would play the trumpet at 2 a.m. But then what about people that say, well, all you have to do is tell people, look, if everybody did that, look what kind of a situation we'd be in. And the person just says, well, everybody isn't doing it. Well, and you say, well, what right do you have to make yourself special? I don't know. I just do my thing. It's okay. Okay, I think I want to stop at that point and get into the Heinz Dilemma. I'll read it for those of you who can't look on, and then we will begin. In Europe, a woman was near death from a special kind of cancer. There was one drug that the doctors thought might save her. It was a form of radium that a druggist in the same town had recently discovered. The drug was expensive to make, but the druggist was charging 10 times what the drug cost him to make. He paid $200 for the radium and charged $2,000 for a small dose of the drug. The sick woman's husband, Heinz, went to everyone he knew to borrow the money, but he could only get together about $1,000, which is half of what it cost. He told the druggist that his wife was dying and asked him to sell it cheaper or let him pay later, but the druggist said, "No, I discovered the drug. I'm going to make money from it." So Heinz got desperate, broke into the man's store to steal the drug for his wife. Should Heinz steal the drug? And then the awful question, why? I'm going to stand up now. I've got a cold. I apologize. I may have to blow my nose every once in a while and get a drink of water. Who would like to start out? Should Heinz steal the drug?
I'll start.
Okay, go ahead, Steve.
The first thing that I thought of was putting myself in Heinz's position and thinking if my wife was sick and such. And I think that I would be willing to steal the drug in order to bring about a cure and suffer the consequences of that so she could live.
Okay. So you think you should steal the drug so she can live. So the reason you're stealing the drug is because of the importance of your wife's life.
Exactly. To enhance her life.
Okay.
Because I think that's worth more than the 10 times he's going to make on the drug.
So it's all right to steal. Thou shalt not steal. It's all right to steal when your wife is dying and you want to save her life.
Yes.
Okay? Everybody agree with that?
I say I'd steal the drug too, but I'm not saying it's okay to steal the drug. And he did say...
Steve
did say, you know, suffer the consequences. Mm-hmm. So whatever that may be, okay, you know, yeah, what I did was wrong, but I'm saving my wife and I'll suffer the consequences.
Okay. Steve, you'd be willing to suffer the consequences. Yeah. Brad, right?
Yeah. Basic agreement with what both Steve and Claire have said. There are other questions that could be asked, and I think I would have to think through. We could also ask, should the druggist be selling this drug for the amount of money that he's selling it for? What should be the appropriate punishment for me if I do steal this drug and I'm apprehended? What should the authorities use as their criteria to evaluate that kind of action? I mean, so I begin to see how there's a whole cobweb of questions that are all connected, and I think I'd have the willingness to steal the drug too, and then realize you pull on that one thread and a lot of other things are going to move, and you have to be willing to be caught up in the complexity of all that.
It's exactly where we want it to move. So Brad, you're the judge. Here's Steve. He's just stolen the drug to save his wife. You know the circumstances of the case. How are you going to plead, Steve? Are you going to plead guilty or not guilty?
Well, it's hard to plead not guilty in light of the fact that I took it. I may be guilty of taking the drug. I guess the other question is, what am I not guilty of?
Yeah, I just want to know if you want to plead guilty or not guilty.
I'll plead nulla contendere.
I know it's a sophisticated group here. Okay, here now, wait a minute here. That is Scott.
Right. Well, I think when Steve, or what's his name?
Heinz,
stole the drug, he was sort of already acting up on a set of morals that had already been established, and that's basically the law, which sort of defines things as being worse than others and imposes a harsher penalty on him. So he knew that it was wrong, but he decided that he was going to, you know, risk what the law had established as being on sort of a degree of wrongness and pay that penalty for what he believed in.
Okay. Yes, and your name again is?
My name's Sue.
Sue.
Yeah. Are we thinking about just whether this is legally right or wrong, or whether we're really breaking the Ten Commandments, or this one of the Ten Commandments?
Well,
is it morally wrong, or is it? I mean,
tell me. Do we have? Is that?
Well, I'd have to think about both sides.
Okay. Tell me about both sides a little bit.
Well, I would have, if it were just a legal law that were keeping me from stealing this drug and saving my wife, then I would, that would be easier to decide. But if this moral law has been made for a certain reason, and I don't really understand why, but I've been taught, but I've been to obey it anyway.
Okay.
Whether I, you know, I'm not supposed to reason out things, I'm just supposed to obey it.
Okay.
Then I wouldn't know what I'd
do. Okay, so there's a tension sometimes between moral law and legal law, constitutional law, the laws of the society. Okay, well, I'm going to get back to you, Brad, the judge, here in a sec. I got so many hands going up. I'm going to lose names here. Let's see. Is it Emil? Is that right?
Emil. Yes.
Emil.
Does this druggist live in Chelan? Everything is so expensive.
Well, maybe in Leavenworth. Yes. Your name again.
I'm the wife.
What do you want to say?
Yeah. What I wanted to say was, when you think about it in terms of this particular case study, it seems easy to arrive at the conclusion that yes, you should steal the drug, because $2,000 is an exorbitant price for this drug. But there are many, many, many poor people in our country who can't afford even the basic medical care for their children. And are we saying, yes, then you can resort to robbery for your basic needs if the society doesn't fulfill your basic needs?
Okay, but immediately, if you'll notice here, we've taken this Heinz dilemma. We still have to get to Brad, the judge. You immediately get from this very personal issue of Heinz and his wife, and we've gotten immediately into the question of social justice and social ethics. We've got the questions now about law and about retributive justice. How should Heinz be punished? We've got questions now about how does this act affect the larger perspective of things in the entire society. I want to get all these issues. I want to get back to Brad and his decision about Heinz, Steve here, and Cindy, but if your comments are...
I'd like to speak to
Joe.
Heinz or Steve's defense here.
Yes.
I think that if he had not done this, he would be committing a greater crime. He would be essentially murdering his wife. Because he has a way to have his wife not die, and by not going in and stealing that drug, he has committed a sin of murder.
Okay, so then that would that be applicable then in all situations, or only situations when somebody's done everything they possibly can to get the money and can't get the money?
I think one has to make other reasonable efforts, yeah.
So that if...
I mean, if this has come down to this is the only way she could not die.
What are you saying? That thought might save
her. It is even sure.
So that if a farm worker in the Wenatchee Valley had a child that was suffering from hepatitis or something and needed drugs and didn't have any insurance and couldn't afford it, the person would be morally obligated, you would say, to steal in order to get that.
I'm putting that forward.
What do you think about that? What do you think about that? Claire?
Well, I disagree, because I don't know, I think that's just really harsh. I don't think you can say that it's murder or equal to that. Plus, there's another person involved. There's the pharmacist. He's the one that's really blocking her from getting the medicine.
I want to get back to the pharmacist too, because I'm not sure we're giving the. We got to make this a little more juicy here and give some credit to the pharmacist.
I'm Margaret.
Margaret. Yes.
I'm wondering about the wife. We're assuming this will cure her. I mean.
Well, unfortunately, we're not. It just says it might.
Considerable, you know. Taking down a considerable chance that it might this work, and then we have to consider that the husband, if he goes to prison or whatever happens, when this is going to have a fact effect on the wife. The person who's trying to help, it may undo all that he does.
So that if Heinz steals the drug and he gets sent to prison, he's got this one dose of the drug, but what happens all the rest of the time if he goes to prison? What are you going to do, Brad?
The judge here.
You're sending him
to- here is this, here's Heinz. He's there. He's stolen the drug. He's pleading guilty. What do you do?
Well, if I were the judge, there are a couple things to take into account. I would want to do my best to ferret out his intent. I think it would make a difference, for instance, if he broke into the pharmacist and maliciously destroyed a lot of things out of anger and then took the drug and so forth, or if in good faith he left the $1,000 that he had, you know, on the counter with a note promising to pay and saying, you know, okay, I'm sorry that it couldn't be worked out more peaceably, but this is it. I think if that were the case, if he was willing to pledge the $1,000 he had, was not malicious in his intent, then I would say still has to be found guilty, still has to be sentenced, because as a judge you have some obligation to uphold civil order. I'd probably give a suspended sentence and make sure that this kind of person was on probation for a sufficiently long period of time that you could keep track of him to know whether it was likely to, you know, continue to do these kind of things or not.
What happened?
Because I think also the unfairness of the pharmacist would play into my decision. If that came to light as part of a trial, that this person was basically extorting money from folks, that would be a part of my decision making.
But you have no leverage over the pharmacist.
We're making an assumption here that the pharmacist is extorting. We'll have to get on to that in a sec. But, if there are circumstances are there, you would put him on some sort of community service time. But would you say, what happens? I mean, he's got one dose of the drug. It doesn't automatically cure with one dose. Do you say, if you do this again, what happens if he's going to do it over and over and over again and keep getting the drug?
Well, I think that's not an option. If you're on some sort of probationary sentence, that's a clear indication that, you know, as a legal official, I hold somebody responsible for that. I'm talking more, I guess, out of a legal framework. Moral things aside, if I'm the judge, I'd have that kind of obligation.
So there's another issue that's being raised here about professional ethics and ethics that depend upon a role that a person is playing. That you might have your own personal feelings, but you feel an obligation based on your contract to fulfill the laws of the city, the state, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you would have to step down?
Yeah, I would say this is not a situation which for me would be such a moral dilemma that I feel the need to step aside. There might be some.
Okay. Who else would like to be a judge here now? Yes, Norman.
Well, let me give you a real life example. When I was issuing visas in Frankfurt, Germany, back in early 60s, a man came in, asked for a visa to immigrate to the United States. I found him ineligible for a visa because he had committed a crime involving moral turpitude. And under Section 212A9 of the Act, he was prohibited. What was that crime? As they say on the Golden Girls, picture this, huh? Germany, after the war, a returning veteran, German veteran, wife and two children. Hungry, homeless, he stole a bag of apples from an orchard, was found guilty by a German judge. He committed a crime involving moral turpitude, and I had to find him ineligible. So the judge in that case determined he broke the law, and being good Germans, and this happens to be in German, I'm sure they wouldn't consider all these things that our pastor friend from San Diego would consider. He broke the law. He's going to pay for it. And this fellow did.
Sounds like the Hugo's novel, right? Les Miserables, isn't that what he stole? An apple or some bread, I guess it was. Yeah. Who else would like to be the judge here? Judge here. Well, let's...
Well, Dan over there wanted.
Dan.
Not only the judge, but I just want to say, yeah, it sounds like it makes a difference of the society of where the judge is in. I imagine it is more important in Germany after World War II, where everyone is desperate to keep a much tighter rein on things, than would be, say, in America at this point in time, because there was probably an extreme a large amount of looting at that time. And you had to keep a stricter control on things, whereas probably in our society we could be a little bit more lenient.
So the situation makes a difference. There are moral absolutes. They depend on the situation in which they're exercised.
Right. The general effect on society of allowing people stealing apples is different in America now than it is in Germany after the war.
Does everybody agree with this situational approach? It depends.
Well, not necessarily. The way it affects the situation is different because of the atmosphere.
Yeah,
it has a different effect.
Okay, let me see if I understand. You're saying that because of the situation in Germany, after all, there's scarcity of food, perhaps, and resources, that they had to be stricter under those circumstances, that here in America, where there's more abundance, we can be more lenient. So the laws apply differently in different circumstances.
And then the way that they affect society, yes.
Right. Sure. Okay.
And you could say that it's always morally wrong to steal, but that the consequences are the motivating factor that motivates the person to steal would reflect on the consequences of that act.
Diane, you wanted to say something, and
I guess I was just going to say that more moral to let people starve to death is sometimes than it is at other times.
Sure. Okay. It's more motivated. Everybody hearing this now? Okay. Everybody? Scott.
I'm wondering what difference it'll make if, say, the couple's in their late 90s. Uh-huh. If they were younger.
Good point. What happens if Cindy here, yeah, she's young, she has a future ahead of her.
Children.
What happens if Cindy is 68? And Steve here is 72. Does that make any difference? Of course, quiet here. Should it make a difference if somebody is older?
No, it shouldn't make a difference because we're all human.
Life is a life?
I agree. Mm-hmm.
So you should still do it. What happens if Cindy is just really hard to get along with?
That's right.
I probably
stole
the medicine in the first place.
Nobody in town likes this lady. She's a pain in the neck. She's been just awful to people most of her life, causing all kinds of trouble. Heinz doesn't like her very much, but he does feel an obligation to his marriage contract. Should he still steal the drug?
I know personally she's an ex-Nazi.
Yeah, she's an ex-Nazi. Right. Okay, let's make it a little more juicy here. Should he still steal the drug? I'm seeing some heads saying no.
I thought a life was a life.
That's right. We did good points, Cindy. We just said a life is a life, right?
I still say yes.
Still say yes. Claire says yes.
What if Cindy was ready to go, ready to die? She had lived her life and she wasn't to be ready.
Okay. What would be the situation if Cindy had told Steve, no, don't. I don't want this drug. Mm-hmm. I just want to die in peace. I don't want to prolong the agony. I'm not sure this is going to cure me. Don't. I've had a long life. It's been good. But then?
Don't steal.
Steve then takes, or Heinz in this case, takes the action. Then he is overriding his wife's wishes, being paternalistic in that sense. Okay.
What's interesting to me is at that point, generally, it seems like in society, there's a physician very active in the mix who starts to take on more power or legislate on something or other.
So you think a physician would intervene or something at this point?
It seems like that you hear about that. If she's at the point of desperation, that her life is going to be lost.
Hey, where's the doctor in this? We don't know. Let's. I'll get Jan, and then I want to get back to the druggist here.
I want to know why Heinz doesn't have other alternatives. True, he's in a small town, but is he really that isolated? Couldn't he appeal to those doctors to act on his behalf? He only goes to the druggist. There must be, couldn't he use some of the money to go to a city and see if, or to figure out if the drug weren't available at a lower...
That's a good point, Jan. We need to bring that up and when we broaden this dilemma a little bit. But in this particular phrasing of the dilemma, he has done everything to get money, everything he possibly can.
Well, to get money, but not to figure out if there are other means of getting the drug.
Now he has $1,000.
This is exactly my feeling on this. These canned things are neatly put down in a few lines. I think they've got to be. I'm not complaining. But I'm convinced that in real life, there are usually more alternatives that are immediately evident. And I guess I'd like to suggest that this is one of the important aspects of moral conflict resolution.
Yes.
Is to be able to identify alternatives which are not readily and immediately available to us. In this case, he's hit up his friends. How about other people? How about the churches? Perhaps there's someone in the community who the druggist respects to which he could work.
So one of the things that's really important, Dean, that I'm hearing you say is that are we really sure we are at the end of our opportunities?
If you start out looking at a moral dilemma, thinking you've got it defined in a few simple terms, I think you're closing yourself off from an awful lot of avenues for really resolving it.
Okay. I think what he's trying to do is force us into the corner, Kohlberg is, and say, you've done it all. You've done every possible thing you can think of. You are morally justified. You've done everything. You've appealed here. You've appealed there. You've done this. You've done that. You've done everything. And now, what do you do? I think that's where he's trying to box us in. But I think it is important. What you're saying is some people might say, well, I tried everything. You say, well, did you do this? Did you do this? Oh, no, never occurred to me. You know, so
is the druggist the last resort now?
You know, the druggist is the only person that has this drug.
Okay. Now, by the time this couple now is 68 and 72, he'll have saved up a lot of money and he'll be on his feet. He can afford to buy it.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the druggist. We're all assuming this druggist is a terrible person because he's making so much money from his drug. What's wrong with making money from a drug? I thought we lived in a capitalist society, for Pete's sake. You put it out there and you get as much money as you can for it. That's how it works, right?
He's a schmuck because he won't take the $1,000 pledge with the promise to pay later. I mean, that's my first reaction. It's not as if somebody's trying to rob you blind. It's someone we have to trust, I think, who's coming in good faith. And there seems to be a very hard-hearted response.
Judge, he comes to you and says, look, Judge, if I did that, there'd be 35 people at my door tomorrow wanting the same thing. This drug takes a lot of work. I've worked a long time on it. If I'm going to lower the price of this, I've got to be able to develop new techniques in order to make it more inexpensively. It's going to take a lot of money for research and development. I realize at the beginning it's terribly expensive, but I've got to do this. If we want this drug available for people, I've got to have the money now so that we can do that. What you're doing is saying I should just simply take this drug and is developing it as primitively as I am, and it'll always stay at that price.
Thank you very much for your testimony. It's very interesting.
Okay.
Yes. And beside that, my mother is ill and has a very serious illness. It's costing me thousands and thousands
That's
of
right.
dollars to maintain her. I've got a hard life too. I mean, and I haven't.
That's very good. So we're assuming on the surface of this that we think that he's being greedy. But there might be extenuating circumstances on his side.
But you've asked us to stick with what we have.
Well, I keep. So. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we can.
But I've got to add a little more to it. I mean, that's what these things are simple. You've got to add more to make it a little more interesting.
Yeah.
But let's imagine. I want to get back to this thing about what is wrong with making a profit if, in fact, in the long run, it's going to make that drug cheaper and available to more people.
Well, it seems to me one of the difficult factors is that there aren't many forums where people can discuss price setting for products. And oftentimes it seems that the law needs to be broken before the courts then are involved in helping determine some kind of policy or some kind of criterion for that kind of issue. And we allow the developer of a particular product to set the price for it.
Okay. So
and it seems like that breaking the law becomes then to get the judge involved. And maybe, I don't know if they can determine price, but at least it opens it up to a larger forum.
So you'd be willing to have the state interfere in the market in this particular case?
I think that's what ends up happening.
Does everybody agree with that? That the state should be able to interfere in commerce in order to be able to set prices in particular areas and things?
No.
Well, that's interesting. He didn't appear to have patent laws, so he has a monopoly for 17 years on the drug.
Okay, yes?
Can a doctor in the United States, can he refuse to give medical treatment to a patient that has cancer? Can he refuse because he doesn't have the money to pay?
Sure.
You know, I'm certainly glad I live in Canada because if a person comes ill with cancer, his entire treatment is absolutely free.
Let's get onto that issue. That's a good point.
In our town, we had four doctors moving from Canada.
Uh-huh. Well, because they earn more money.
That's
down
right.
Here.
Okay. Yeah.
Diane wants to say something here.
I guess I want to get back to the society again. We do this all the time to people, and if we think about it, it's going to cost us a lot more for his trial and to maintain him in prison than if we provided her with the drug that she needed.
Thinking about consequences here, but let's get back to the society here. Does what I'm hearing, the beginnings of discussion here? You wait a minute here. I want to get here to Kara.
Well, I just instead of having government interference set the prices. I mean, it seems that there ought to be somewhere that they should be able to get some money or funds available to them. If they've tried everything, they've got this $1,000. There should be some place somewhere where they can get the other $1,000, you know, on a loan or whatever. You know, it's.
Let's talk about the other ways here. Doris, one second.
There's the American Cancer Society that does give some help.
Okay, let's look at it in light of this village. What is the response, or does the village have any responsibility for Heinz's wife? Or to put it more broadly, does the community have an obligation to its citizens in this particular kind of situation?
Moral obligation?
Yeah.
Well, it's the citizens, right? I mean, it's the citizens that make up the community.
So if the citizens say, heck no, we're a libertarian community, people are on their own, you just do your own thing and you take care of yourself and that's it, that's fine, right? That's the community decides, and the community's rules are every man for himself, every woman, tough luck.
Yeah, probably wouldn't do that. I mean, you could pick up a collection and he did.
Okay. So
are we saying that they are like that? Or
no,
I'm
just...
What if they were? Like that?
What if they were? I mean, how...
But they wouldn't be. I mean, you could say what if forever, you know?
Okay. So you're saying that the community at least ought to be willing voluntarily...
Right.
You think most people would? It's optimistic. It's great. But should there be rules in the community, laws, in the terms again of what Steve is suggesting, that in cases like this, the community has an obligation to its citizens, as in Canada, to sort of protect the general health of the community by providing sort of a basic floor of health insurance, let's say.
We have a health insurance in Canada, and I understand that down in the States here, they're scared of us because they think it's communism.
I don't think everybody here thinks that, but I think there are many people that do, especially living south of Orange County, or in Orange County in Lower California.
Haven't we traditionally left this up to the hospitals whether they would take the patient with no money and so forth?
Which we have.
Nobody else has taken responsibility. There have been these organizations. The society
itself. Okay. Let's move this thing along a little bit. Let's say it's not Heinz's wife at all. Let's say it's his sister. Does that make a difference? Okay, let's say that it is the woman down the street from Heinz and his wife. They've known her all their life. She's alone, doesn't have many resources. She's got this cancer. Heinz still have the obligation to steal?
Surely the church in the area where this woman lives has her great responsibility to help her.
Okay, let's say, getting ourselves in the hard corner again, that the church done everything it possibly can, the whole community's raised up all its money voluntarily, and still hasn't gotten the $2,000. And this woman is there, stuck.
So what should she
And she want, and I'm assuming she wants, let's assume that she's like, well, she's like Cindy, she's got kids, she's alone, she's a single mother. She's got two or three kids. You know?
Of course, it seems to me you're now raising the question of what is community.
Okay.
In my own business, when you have 800 million people starving in the world because of apathy on the part of those of us who have plenty, what kind of community is that? Or does it just go to the wife or to the sister or the lady down the street? Or does it go to that person in Chiqui Chiqui, Brazil?
That's because Norman is getting ahead of me. We can normally move this thing along and say, oh yes, we ought to as a church do something for this, or as a community or neighbors for this woman, and you know, maybe we ought to just sort of take turns stealing or something. And then you raise the question, well, what happens if you're watching television and you hear about a person in, what's the name?
Chiqui
Chiqui, Brazil.
Yes.
Who is in this terrible situation. And they're making a plea for help. Are you obligated, do you feel morally, are you morally obligated to respond to that person's plight? Why?
Scriptures ask, who is your neighbor?
And a life is a life.
So life is a life?
Yeah, but, I mean, can you respond to everything?
Aha.
Didn't Jesus say there will always be poor? And I forget the exact story, but
it's going to help make sure that
there is. No. But I mean, what do you do? Because there's everybody out there to help them.
So to what extent?
Yeah. How do you draw the line at your neighbor?
Yeah.
How do you draw that line?
Or
where do you
draw a line at a neighbor? Just when do you stop giving them?
We need some help here, folks. We're stuck here. I mean, this person in Chiqui Chiqui, Brazil is needing help. Or let's just make it more realistic. You hear about a young child who needs a liver transplant. It's a 7-year-old child. He is often on the news. Things. It's in little.
Take his liver.
That's right. Do you feel a moral obligation to respond, and ought you respond to that feeling?
Well, the American people, I think Canadians too are included, are very generous people, and if something tragic happens around the other side of the world, the Americans are the first people to respond, to send ships and planes with supplies. Now, I know it says in the scripture, the Ten Commandments, the one reads, thou shalt not steal. But I think there are circumstances where you have to go over that, and still, I would say stealing in this case wouldn't be morally wrong, because one time David was hungry, and he went into the temple, and he ate bread that was sacrificial, or was there for a sacrificial purpose. Bread of sacrifice. Maybe someone can correct
him. Yep. The shrewbread.
And he because he was hungry. And so, and God, I just feel this way, that God is not going to condemn this gentleman over here because he stole.
Okay, but let's go back again to this, back to Chiqui Chiqui, Brazil, and you'll see how this dilemma can get us beyond things. Let's say that Brazil is right on our border, and there are lots of people in Chiqui Chiqui, Brazil, who don't have very much. Across the border, there are people who have way, way more than they need. They've done everything they can with their resources to provide their needs, to protect their families, to provide a good life for them. We see no response on the other side from people who have much. We say that stealing is okay when life is threatened, especially your own family's life. Then if their situation is desperate and they've done everything they possibly can, would it be all right for them to organize, to come and steal from what we have in order to take back something of ours to maintain or to assist their families? Sonia.
I was just thinking, what is stealing? Somebody prayed last night during the worship service to about us stealing from the poor just by our sheer existence, by our way of life, we take from other people. So what is stealing?
It's another good question.
I think there's an element of trust too. You have to trust that it's really going to help the wife. And same, like you hear the pleas on TV and that to help somebody in another country follow up. I'm not so sure that I trust that they're going to receive that money.
Yeah. I'm afraid I may have to cut this short, and I hope the discussion will continue, but you can see how you can take a seemingly very personal moral dilemma and its ramifications can become global as you think about it. It also, I think, helps us to see that what on the surface in a simple paragraph is really much, much more complex. We need to know much, much more than is there. So often, when we hear about things through the media, papers and stuff, we only know a very little bit about what's going on. Not always do we know all of the circumstances, and sometimes people jump quickly to conclusions about things. But, you know, in this day and age, you have to also act. And sometimes you have to act on insufficient information. You have to act given the best you can possibly do. And as Christians, trust in the forgiveness of God. Right? It's better to act in some ways and be wrong than to not do anything for fear of being wrong, because we do have a loving and forgiving God who will forgive us if we repent when we see we did wrong. And I suspect we're like the people gathered to stone the woman caught in adultery. We've all probably made a few mistakes in our lives. Let me just give some more background before we move on to tomorrow. And I want to close with a quote for those of you who will not be here the rest of the time, just so you get some general sense of things here. Let me say something about the work of Lawrence Kohlberg, which I've admired greatly. I think for the man from experiences in World War II, which really shook him primarily. It was the turning back of Jewish refugees that had to leave our shores and were abandoned on the ships, and many of the ships sank. He was just appalled by this and wanted to study how it is that people come to their moral philosophy, let's say. And in doing this, he studied a group of 75 boys originally, up over time, longitudinally, and then he expanded and studied in Guatemala and Turkey, and I believe in Taiwan as well. Himself getting very sick in the process, got a parasite which made him very ill several times. Out of this came a schema that showed that people generally reason morally at three levels: pre-conventional, conventional, and post-conventional. And these three levels are each divided into two. Level one, or stage one, it's wrong if you get punished. Your basic sort of child. You know, if I'm going to get slapped, I'm not going to do it. I've had experience in my own ministry to deal with an adolescent who really amazed me, who said, no, what I did wasn't wrong because nobody caught me. It wasn't wrong. Nobody said it was wrong. Nobody's punished me, so I guess it's right. But she literally was at stage one in her moral reasoning. Stage two is the famous, I'll do something for you if you'll do something for me. This is the, God, if you get me through this, I promise I will always. You know, or, so that those two stages are the pre-conventional. Conventional, where most of us reside, are not probably most people here, because this is a select group, but most people reside in three and four. And that stage three is dominated by the sense of being nice or good. Kohlberg says being a nice girl and a good boy. Okay. And there's a fourth stage, which is a stage which is the true believer stage. You obey the rules. I mean, the rules are there and they are ultimate and you obey them. Post-conventionally, you get to stage five, where you recognize that there are higher principles upon which, from which you derive laws. Laws themselves are not absolute. There are higher laws. And then stage six, ultimately principled reasoning, where you recognize the responsibility to come to your own ultimate moral principles to which you are ultimately bound beyond everything else. His work is very interesting. It's worthy of being read and should be read. However, and some of you here know this, it's been severely questioned recently, most strongly by one of his own students, Carol Gilligan, who wrote a book in a different voice and found out when you studied women, lo and behold, women don't seem to go through stage four. They go 1, 2, 3, 5. Mm-hmm. You know, and there seems to be a different way of conceiving of morality, not so much in terms of rules and laws, but in terms of keeping the community together and functioning. Some problems, as I understand, with Carol Gilligan's work in that it's not really open for people to investigate. So I don't know if it's been replicated. I haven't heard it. Maybe some of you know if her work has been replicated by anybody else to confirm this problem. And then there are other people who raise real questions about Kohlberg because of the distinct Kantian bias that runs through it, that, you know, morality has this particular kind of look, sort of the expansion of what Carol Gilligan was having to say.
Excuse me, could you do six again?
They do all six.
Just number six. Okay,
principle of reason. It's like Kant's, you should treat people only as ends and never as means only. Kant, we'll deal with Kant tomorrow. Okay, let's talk for a second then about what is morality, just briefly. It's about knowing the difference between right and wrong. Okay, it's also about, honestly, just simply coming up with good enough reasons for your actions. Preferably good enough reasons so that the onus is on anybody who would disagree with you to come up with better reasons. Okay? I say that because there is not a predominant moral philosophy around right now. Everything seems to be quite in flux. And this is different from aesthetics, economics, and law, which are also about right and wrong, in a sense, decisions. But we're talking about a different kind of right and wrong. And knowing right and wrong is really what moral philosophy is about. But there's also the question of, is it just knowing? What about the doing? How do you develop moral character so that people will actually do what they know? And Kohlberg has something to say about that in terms of stage six especially, but I don't want to go into that now. It's too technical.
Can I make a comment on that, what you just said?
Yes.
What is morally right and wrong? In the sight of God, we are free to do as we please, providing what we do pleases God.
Right. So all we have to know is what pleases God. And we got it.
What pleases us.
No, it's true. It is, in some ways, it's very simple. In other ways, it's extremely difficult. And we'll get to this when we read Smead's little thing at the end here. And we're running out of time, and I'm probably off the tape, but it's the way it goes. But I want you to get this. Tom Beecham, in his book, gives these four criteria for moral decisions, what makes it moral. Supremely authoritative or overriding as a guide to action. It is prescriptive. It tells us what we ought to do. It is universalizable, meaning that it applies in a similar way to all people situated in relevantly similar circumstances. You can't say, this is okay for me now, but it's not okay for you, even though you are in the relevantly similar circumstance. So you can't sort of make exceptions for yourself. It has to apply across the board. And finally, fourthly, it's concerned about the welfare of others. All right. Then, and I'm going to have, of course, right here at the end, I won't be able to talk. I just want to bring up again the fact that liberalism is coming under extreme questioning right now. I'm not talking about liberalism in the political sense. I'm talking about liberalism in the philosophical sense as it arose from the time of the Enlightenment. The whole Enlightenment project is under severe criticism in lots of different circles. The belief in the supremacy of the autonomous individual is coming under question. Are we really predominantly autonomous individuals, or is there a connection between community and the individual? And how do these things interrelate? There is a critique of John Rawls' A Theory of Justice by a man named Sandel, Michael Sandel, also at Harvard.